from the Mutual Broadcasting System. This is STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. Now, retired Marine Intelligence Officer and globally recognized risk expert, Hal Kempfer.
Welcome to STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. I'm really happy you're here, but I can't say what I'm talking about is necessarily uplifting. In fact, I'm going to talk about some things that are rather shocking, stunning, breaking, if you will. Yeah, I'm going to talk about something not overseas, not tied to war or anything like that, something that actually happened here in the U.S. I'm based in Southern California. It actually happened here in Southern California. It actually happened this morning about 11 o'clock in Palm Springs. And there was a car bomb at a reproduction center, a reproduction clinic where they do IVF, they do surrogacy, they do a lot of things with embryos, and a car bomb exploded. From looking at all of the video of what took place there, it was a fairly powerful car bomb. I can see where it blew out a brick wall, and there was bricks blown out across the street. There's talk of debris over quite some area. So it appears that the bomb was probably not something that was just added to the bottom of the car, but probably something that had been basically put into the car at some point and was a rather sizable explosive. I don't know. That's all being worked out. That's part of the forensic investigation. That's what alcohol, tobacco, or ATF, alcohol, tobacco, firearms working on, the FBI is working on, Palm Springs PD, Riverside Sheriffs, the fire departments that are involved. All of them are trying to figure out what this was, and then, of course, trying to figure out who did it, and then, of course, trying to figure out, is this a one-off, or is this part of something bigger that could continue? So they're all working on this. Why a reproduction center? And I'm sure some are scratching their heads. It's like, well, didn't we used to have attacks, violent extremist attacks or attacks? And I'm not saying for sure that it is terrorism or violent extremism. We're going to find out that more about that. This could be an individual that had a personal grievance, or it could be someone despondent that decided they were going to blow themselves up in a spectacular fashion. But then I guess the question would be, why at that reproduction center? Why would you do something like that? And the reproduction center, what it is and where it is, really kind of jumps out. And that's why I'm sure they're going to go to to great lengths to try and figure out, was this tied to violent extremism or was it domestic terrorism per se? There is an anti-IVF movement, if you will. They're not all violent extremists. There are many members of Congress that have last year co-sponsored legislation to limit access to IVF. And it's based on very strong religious feelings, in many cases, ethical feelings, that in the IVF process, where there's multiple eggs, if you will, potentially in that process during the, for lack of a better term, insemination, you can have multiple viable embryos or potential fetuses that could come out of that. And during that process, one is used and then the others will not be used. They will be discarded. And there are some that feel that that discarding of those inseminated eggs is murder, that what they have done is murder individuals or murder people, murder a person or persons in that process. And so they see what happens at the IVF clinics as essentially homicide, a homicidal act or a mass homicidal act, depending on how you want to interpret it. That's how some of them feel about that. They also many times feel very strong about surrogacy. Some of it's because it's tied to the IVF process itself. Some of them just feel that surrogacy is just something that is not intended by nature, and therefore they have very strong feelings about that. And then, of course, Palm Springs. Palm Springs has a national, international reputation of being a center for LGBTQ activities, events. There's a very large residency population. A little bit less than half the population is LGBTQ. The city council is majority LGBTQ. And there is a significant anti-LGBTQ movement in the United States, and many of those also will be anti-LGBTQ, anti-IVF, anti-surrogacy. And with same-sex couples, you'll often find that IVF and surrogacy is a very common practice. So there's a lot of reasons why violent extremists or terrorists would center on hitting a facility like this in Palm Springs. And that's one of the things, that's one of the hypotheses that they're going to have to work on. Beyond it just being intentional, was it tied to this? And it's very likely that it was. Now, there's been, by the way, there's terrorism all over the whole issue here. I mean, there was anti-abortion terrorism for a very long time. And you may recall after the Supreme Court reversed Roe v. Wade, that there was a violent extremist who had a assassination plot to take out Justice Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court, which was actually, I think, maybe the first case of pro-life, or not pro-life, but pro-choice abortion or pro-choice terrorism that I had seen. So that there is this is one of those issues that inflames passions across the board, and some of those inflamed passions turn into acts of violence at various different locations. So that's something we're going to have to see what it is. There's just a lot of things there, and we'll find out what this is. What's interesting to me is that there's a lot of different agencies involved. You're seeing FBI, ATF, as I mentioned, all the local agencies are there working in unified command. If it is determined it is a terrorist act, then the FBI by jurisdiction will take lead. That's what they do. So you'll see that. Now, the question might be in some people's minds, why wasn't this prevented? Why didn't they pick up on this? Well, it gets into the indications and warning, the pre-incident indicators that you have to look for. In many cases, certainly today, you have to look online. The communication, the coordination, the radicalization, if you will, to a large part, much of that is occurring online. And many of these online communities are geographically, these individuals and groups are geographically very disparate. In some cases, they're all over the country, all over the nation. In some cases, they're in other nations. They just share the same beliefs. And so it's difficult. Then you see with things, for example, with Signal and encrypted end-to-end communications, the ability of these groups to communicate in a far more secure environment than they ever used to in the past. It has been greatly enhanced. It makes it more difficult for law enforcement, unless they have very specific, reasonable suspicion that violent, mass violent activities or violent activities are being discussed in these forums, that they cannot necessarily get in there and try to intercept those communications or deal with the investigations in that way. So what really occurs is they have to be looking within their communities for individuals who express these beliefs. And they've got to do a lot of basic community police work, which is talk to people. And by the way, in some cities, I won't say which ones, but in some cities, that means the police officers got to get out of their cars. All right. And they can't just be responding to calls for service. They've got to be going in there and engaging, proactively engaging with the local population, proactively engaging with parts of the population that they may not want to proactively engage with, and having discussions and finding these things out, and then dealing with this information as it comes in to try and create an intelligence picture. The other part of this is that after a lot of work on the intelligence side domestically after 9/11, a lot of those skill sets, a lot of that knowledge kind of waned because things became over-dependent on these database systems, these information systems that we have. I won't say which vendors, but some vendors would come in and they'd say, hey, look, you don't have to learn all this new stuff. You don't have to think differently. You don't have to approach this stuff differently. All you got to do is have the information flow into our magic box, and it will do all that stuff for you. And presto magico, you'll always get out your perpetrators and everything else. And they would very much sell what's capable of doing. And someone who's been involved with the area of link analysis in both manual format and automated format for well over three decades, I can tell you that some of the stuff they say, and there's some incredibly powerful hardware and software out there that can do some amazing things that are tremendously labor-saving, that can find things that if you were looking yourself, you'd have a very tough time finding, but they're not the magic answer. And certainly with artificial intelligence today, that lends itself even more to people leaning on that. But at some point, you really need to focus on intelligence. And I feel that we were kind of going that direction for about a decade or so after 9/11. And then we started kind of pulling back and saying, oh, look, we can do all these systems and stuff. And so we don't have to do this different methodology. And by the way, it is very different. Intelligence and investigations have a lot of overlap, but there's some big differences with this as well. And there's always been a discomfort factor with the law enforcement investigative communities, if you will, with incorporating intelligence as anything beyond a, dare I say, an administrative support function to investigations. And that's a big problem. It's not unique to law enforcement or public safety. We see the same problem in industry. Usually those companies that don't incorporate competitive intelligence or broader analysis in some way, shape, or form, at least the larger companies, many cases, they don't do it for a lot of reasons that are internally driven by corporate culture, and they don't do so well as opposed to those that do, but public sector is a little bit different, and then they can, you know, because of who they are by the mandate, they can get away with some stuff. So that's probably part of the reason why this wasn't picked up on earlier, although anyone will tell you, you're never going to get 100%. You're always going to miss some. You know, there were some things. There have been some big plots and plans and things that have been stopped, prevented, if you will. And this just wasn't one of them. But I did see that, and I've seen it since the mid-teens. We've had a problem with this, all right? And we've had a problem with some things where some of the training that was gone out there in places you would not expect, like California, some of the training out there was really, really bad. And they were wasting a lot of valuable time with officers and others, training them to look for things that may have fit somebody's concept of what they thought the threat was. But, you know, I specifically think of something. Southern Poverty Law Center did a big report on some training California was doing for a dozen years. And I know personally that from discussions that this was being used in a variety of academies and stuff around the state where they were profiling African-American men as the most likely terrorists. They have a section in there where they profile a black man married to a white woman as an indicator of terrorism, and then kind of throw some overarching stuff where basically they're describing Islam, the entire faith of 1.8 billion people, as being a terrorist belief system. Not only is that wrong and particularly dangerous when you consider if that rolls into decisions on use of force and other things, but it has bigger implications than that. I can tell you right now, this last week, President Trump was visiting Saudi Arabia, talking to the Crown Prince. I don't think the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia would be too thrilled to find out that there's widespread training of law enforcement in the United States where Islam is being described as a terrorist, inherently terrorist belief system. Beyond all the issues with civil rights, constitutional rights, you know, everything else, there's international implications with stuff like that because of what Saudi Arabia is. I mean, that is the kingdom that protects the two holiest sites of Islam. So there's reasons why stuff like that should not be done. So there's been some, not just a lack of training or a lack of focus on this, but there's been some really bad stuff out there which has pointed us in other directions where we look. Now, I don't know who the perpetrators were. I don't know what it is. I would be surprised if this attack that took place in Palm Springs was tied to Islamic extremism or some sort of jihadist activity. I just don't anticipate that. All right. Maybe some of those involved or one of those involved may also hold anti-government or anti-corporate beliefs, but I don't think that was the main reason they chose that particular target. And I don't think this was something tied to violent extremist communist beliefs. So anyway, enough said on that. I'm going to move on and talk about President Trump's trip to the Middle East. As I mentioned, he visited a number of places. He visited Saudi Arabia, Qatar or Qatar, depending on how you want to pronounce it. I usually call it Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates or UAE. And he went to these countries, and I think the White House will say they got about $2 trillion worth of commitments Some of these things were like memorandums of understanding. There wasn't a whole lot of substance to them. And even then, when adding those up, I think Reuters or somebody came up with like $730 billion that they could total. But it wouldn't be the first time that a president has gone overseas and maybe made claims of what they're getting back from another country that might have been slightly more than what you could actually tangibly add up on a ledger. Nonetheless, there were some very significant things that came out of this, and not the least of which was that Qatar Airways in particular is going to buy an enormous number of Boeing 787s, which was a real boost for Boeing company that's had some true setbacks the last few years. So that was very significant. $42 billion in armaments and weapons purchases from the United States by Saudi Arabia. That is huge. I think that is the largest singular commitment to buy arms in history from another country. I can't recall anything else bigger that took place selling to a foreign country U.S. weapons. So that's huge. And then, of course, the AI thing, which really culminated in the UAE wanting to build this massive AI center, if you will, artificial intelligence capability. But frankly, that was following throughout because there was a U.S.-Saudi business conferences that had a number of high-tech firms, CEOs there. Elon Musk, for example, was there. And AI was a big topic of conversation at that thing. And it kind of flowed throughout all three of those visits. So that all took place, and that was big. And, you know, there's a lot made out of the fact that he did not stop in Israel on the way out and talk to Bibi Netanyahu, the prime minister. But frankly, he's met with Bibi Netanyahu at least twice since he's been in office, hasn't been back in office that long. And these countries, he hadn't met with their foreign leaders. And so it was a chance to spend time with them. The other thing that was kind of hanging out there was the possibility he might jet up to Turkey to sit down with President Putin, and President Zelensky. President Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, Putin, of course, being from Russia. And Putin had the previous weekend said, I need to meet Zelensky, meet me in Turkey, we'll sit down and talk. And not surprisingly, everybody kind of expected it. Then he just kind of blew off flying down there and didn't even send any senior folks like Foreign Minister Lavrov. He sent these lower level lackeys, if you will, that really weren't anything. And of course, that turned into not much, except, of course, they did reach an agreement to, I should say, the Ukrainian representatives with their Russian counterparts. They're exchanging 1,000 POWs each, which is not an insignificant achievement, but Russia kind of returned to its maximalist. You know, we want to take over all those areas that we claim that we don't even control, and Ukraine needs to fall back. Ukraine needs to start disarming, and you need to get rid of Zelensky and his government, basically setting the seeds for a Russian takeover of Ukraine. And that's just never, ever, ever going to happen. That's that. But they did pledge that they will meet again. I don't see these particular negotiations, certainly at that level, achieving much, but that's what's going on. However, at the same time this was going on, there was a big international foreign ministers conference going in Turkey. Secretary Rubio was there. Secretary Rubio was on hand if he needed to jump in to represent the United States in any, you know, Ukraine-Russia discussions. That was not necessary. But then the next day on Friday, and Zelensky, by the way, said, "Hey, I'm here. You know, you called this meeting. I'm here. I'm waiting for you." And I half expected him to do the empty chair thing where he's sitting in a chair and then looking at an empty chair and saying, "And this is President Putin, who called this meeting. Look over here." He didn't quite do that, although he did do one press conference where he was the chair, sitting in the chair, and there was nobody else there. And it was kind of off to a slant. I go, kind of making the illusion, if you will, that Putin is not there, you know, his non-presence making it known. But with that said, Putin, there's no other way to put this. I mean, Putin literally really just embarrassed himself on the global stage. There's no other way to say this. You know, whether he was afraid to meet with Zelensky or he had nothing to say or everything that he said about a ceasefire or peace process was kind of laid bare as being transparently a nothing burger, that he has no intention of slowing down or stopping the war. That was all kind of laid bare. And it was very clear for everybody in the world to see President Trump kind of has to work on this. He's supposed to have a phone call with Putin. And then they've said they may have a meeting at some point in the future. We'll see what comes out of that. But But Zelensky flew to Albania and had this European leaders meeting, which is, you know, primarily built around the leaders of the EU, and got tremendous pledges of support across the board. And things are different now. Things are different than they were, say, 3 months ago or 2 months ago. Europe is really putting a lot of investment towards defense matters. All these European nations, and in some ways, the leaders of Britain, France, Germany, and Poland have kind of replaced what the president of the United States was doing, certainly under the Biden administration, in terms of taking a leadership role in this war, working with Ukraine. They have all pledged adamant support for Ukraine. And frankly, there is no real way that the Russians are going to make great strides. I know they have a big plan. They're putting things in place to do this big offensive, but it's difficult to see any way they can do it. And one thing that's not reported every day, because it's kind of a gradual thing, is that Ukraine is producing a lot of its own ammunition. It's producing artillery rounds. It's producing a slew of really top quality drones, missiles. They've been doing these deep strikes all over Russia, taking the war home to the Russian people. And so it's just not what it was a year ago. It's not what it was 6 months ago. And frankly, Ukraine is holding a lot of cards. That's the only way to say it. And so it's a different situation. We'll see how that rolls out. Also going on in the background was the Iran nuclear negotiations. Very interesting. Steve Witkoff went over there in the early on of this negotiation process and came back and said, we've got a deal. And we're going to allow the Ukrainians to enrich to 3.67%. I'm not sure what happened there, but he basically outlined the same thing that was in the JCPOA, the agreement that the first Trump administration pulled out of because it was so poorly, or at least they said it was so poorly put together, so poorly constructed, that it left out so many things. And then he just basically laid out the same terms that were in the original agreement, which led to a lot of bipartisan, what is this, Obama II? We're going back and putting back in place the same agreement we had before. And that was painful, I'm sure, for the White House. And sometime over time, it's clear that we have backtracked on that. And we're saying, no, they cannot enrich uranium. I don't know if that's going to stick or we're going to back off and allow them to do some enrichment. It's not clear, but right now we're saying no. And there's some, outline of a thing where maybe that enriched uranium would come through Arab countries, such as the ones that President Trump just visited, and that would be provided to Iran as enriched uranium for their civilian nuclear purposes, and they would not enrich uranium in Iran itself. That's a possibility as well, but we'll see where that goes. But Iran has said we must have enrichment capability, and if we don't, that's a red line, and the U.S. is pretty much right now saying no enrichment capability that Iran will have when this agreement's in place. And so I'm kind of waiting to see how this whole thing kind of rolls out with what it is. And every time the discussion ends, at least from the U.S. side, which is, oh, by the way, if you don't agree, there will be something really bad that will happen to you. And there's a lot of U.S. military forces in the region. At one point, we had about a half dozen B-2 bombers sitting in Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, waiting to be tasked with a strike mission. Of course, those bombers can drop the 30,000-pound MOP, or MOP, the massive ordnance penetrator bomb, these huge conventional explosives that burrow into the earth, explode, and cause massive destruction of underground bunkers, facilities, shelters, things like that. What would be needed to go after the Iranian nuclear facilities? There's many of which are deeply buried underground. So that was all standing by. And now there's B-52s that have taken their place. Not quite the same, certainly not stealth, but a very capable platform. And so there is a beyond that, but there is a carrot along with that stick, which the carrot is that if they go along with this, we'll start dropping sanctions on Iran. Now, one thing was kind of interesting this week was that President Trump met with al-Shara, or what we used to call al-Jilani, when he was a bona fide jihadist terrorist. He's now the head of state of Syria, and they met in Saudi Arabia with the crown prince, there. And apparently President Erdogan of Turkey was on the phone with them at the time, or virtually present, if you will. And you may recall that Turkey was primarily backing that HTS-led coalition that overthrew the Assad government in Syria. And we said that we're dropping sanctions on Syria. Keep in mind, the sanctions on Syria were there because of what the Assad government was doing and their ties to Iran and everything else. So rather interesting, pretty bold move. Some have kind of said this is one of those things that happens every once in a while. Certainly a lot of risk involved. I mean, this guy used to be a member of Al-Qaeda. He led the Al-Qaeda affiliate there called Al-Nusra Front. So certainly, you know, we had a $10 million bounty on this guy's head. So he's not what I call a good guy by any means. I don't think I'd be too inclined to shake his hand, but it happened. You know, we'll find out where this goes. Was it a Nixon, only Nixon could go to China type moment, or will this go some other direction? Don't know yet, but that's what came out this week as well. So those are pretty interesting things. So a lot of different things happening this week. With that said, I'm not going to get into, I was going to talk about some other things dealing with disaster preparedness, but I think we've covered a lot of material here. So I'm going to kind of leave it at this, and I will talk about that in another segment. But thanks. Appreciate you listening to Strat. And by the way, please, you're listening to stratpodcast.com, the website where this can be found, also found wherever you find your podcast, Apple or anyplace else. Or you can go to Hal Kimfer TV on YouTube, where a lot of my news segments are located. And you can always go to GRIPSA or GRIPSA.com, which is my company website. And there's links to all the other things where you can see me and hear me and my various incarnations. Thanks for listening to this podcast.